From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
When I showed up for jury duty, I was thinking to get out and use my time to better advantage. But something in my gut told me that if I served as a juror, I would make a difference. I had no idea how much difference I would make.
A juror forces a hung jury, tries to bail out the defendant in a $10 heroin case, and the CIA provided the information to the Peruvian jet that shot a missionary out of the sky. Today, a look at what the CIA does in Peru and the internationalization of the U.S. drug war. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. An elite U.S.-trained Colombian Army battalion has killed rebel fighters for the first time. The troops, part of Counter-Narcotics Battalion 1, killed 9 FARC guerrillas and lost one of their own men during combat in the Guamuez Valley in Putumayo Province. The fighting began on mid-Monday and ended early Tuesday as part of Operation Hurricane, which the Army said in a statement was aimed at drugs and not combating rebel forces. Counter-Narcotics Battalion 1 was trained by the United States as part of a $1 billion package of mainly military aid for President Andres Pastrana's Plan Colombia. An audio tape made aboard a U.S. surveillance plane shows that its CIA crew expressed doubts about whether a civilian aircraft they were tracking was smuggling drugs 20 minutes before it was shot down last week by the Peruvian Air Force. But they did not vigorously object until just before it came under fire. U.S. officials previously said the three crew members strenuously resisted the shootdown, but the tape, described to the Washington Post by U.S. officials, shows that the crew displayed little urgency as the Peruvian jet approached the plane because they expected it to take a closer look and read the plane's registration number. They sounded surprised when the jet attacked. The FBI raids the Independent Media Center in Seattle. According to authorities, security plans intended to protect Western leaders attending the Summit of the Americas in Quebec City were taken from a car over the weekend and posted hours later on the Seattle Indy Media website. On Saturday night, FBI agents raided the offices of the Independent Media Center in downtown Seattle, seizing computer log records, according to federal sources. No arrests have been made. One federal criminal justice source said the speed with which the sensitive stolen document appeared on the internet speaks to the sophistication of the movement that is opposed to unrestricted global trade. According to federal criminal justice sources quoted in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, the organization has committed no clear-cut violation of U.S. law by posting the document on the web, and the action may be protected as free speech. Justice Department lawyers have warned that they may soon be forced to abandon the federal government's landmark lawsuit against the tobacco industry because the Bush administration has not proposed enough funding to keep the litigation alive. This according to a confidential memo reviewed by the Washington Post. Justice lawyers have estimated they need more than $57 million in the coming fiscal year to continue the government's lawsuit, which seeks more than $100 billion in damages from tobacco companies for allegedly engaging in a 45-year pattern for racketeering. While they need more than $57 million to continue the lawsuit, the budget proposed by President Bush holds the budget at $1.8 million. The defendants in the case include Philip Morris, R.J. Reynolds Tobacco, Brown & Williamson Tobacco, Lorillard Tobacco, and American Tobacco. And this from Al Kamen's column in The Loop in The Washington Post. Did someone say military-industrial complex? President Bush announced his intention yesterday to nominate 2 service secretaries employed at giant defense contractors and one who's a bigwig at energy giant Enron. Gordon England, executive vice president of General Dynamics, is to be secretary of the Navy. James Roach, corporate vice president at Northrop Grumman, is to be secretary of the Air Force. And retired General Thomas White, vice chair of Enron Energy Services Corporation, is the pick to be Secretary of the Army. Mark Thiessen, longtime press secretary for Jesse Helms, will be taking over as chief speechwriter for Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Former Governor Christy Todd Whitman is being sued by the man she was photographed frisking during a police ride-along in 1996. Sharon Rolax says he was targeted by New Jersey State Police because he's black and was victimized, in part because Whitman and the troopers had a, quote, cavalier attitude toward racial profiling. Rolax was 17 and unarmed when he was frisked by Whitman, who was patrolling Camden streets as part of a crackdown on crime. And more than three dozen students have occupied the office of Harvard University President Neil Rudenstein since April 18th. They're demanding a living wage for Harvard's custodians, cooks, and other blue-collar workers, said one student. With a $19 billion endowment and a governing board of multimillionaires, Harvard has no excuse for perpetuating poverty conditions. Harvard wasn't the only campus with student demonstrations this week. At Penn State University, more than 100 students spent the night at a student union building protesting reported death threats against the Black Caucus president. And challenging the U.S. government, Puerto Rico's governor filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Navy yesterday to halt bombing exercises on Vieques. The U.S. Navy, which called the lawsuit a grave development in relations between the Navy and Puerto Rico, posted notices in Vieques saying maneuvers will resume on Friday.
They say we don't need another little angry mouth to feed, but what I would say on the double.
No More Trouble by Bob Marley and the Wailers here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. In what may be the first case of its kind, a juror in a New York drug case involving the sale of a $10 bag of heroin bailed out the defendant 3 weeks ago. The juror, Paula Thompson, was the lone dissenter in the drug case, which resulted in a hung jury and a mistrial. She says she believes the evidence was flimsy. Calvin Baker, who's African-American, was arrested in December of 1999 when a policeman claimed he witnessed the defendant sell a small bag of heroin on West 127th Street in Harlem. The policeman saw the exchange through binoculars from 270 feet away, nearly a football field away. The police arrested Baker 2 hours later outside of his apartment. He had no drugs on him. The jury, which had no African Americans, was ready to convict Baker, but Paula Thompson refused to back down. Under the Rockefeller drug laws, Baker faces a mandatory 4 to 5 to 9 years in prison and could get as many as 25. Thompson then posted the $2,500 bail for Baker. The judge responded by ordering an investigation between the relationship between Thompson and Baker. No prior relationship was found. But 3 days after Thompson posted bail, another judge raised it to $10,000, saying it was against public policy for a juror to post bail for a defendant. We're joined right now by the juror in the case, Paula Thompson, as well as Calvin Baker's attorney, Leonard Levinson, who is an officer with the New York Criminal Bar Association. Well, Paula Thompson, tell us about this case. First, you hang on for 3 days against a jury that is completely against you. You hang the jury, and then you put up bail for the defendant.
Well, first, I'd like to say I think they hung the jury, too, because most of those 3 days of deliberation were based on personal criticisms of me rather than discussing the merits of the case. Whenever I would get back to discussing the case, they would drown me out. And they took an oath as jurors to hear out the other people, and they wouldn't. They would drown me out and talk over me. I even, at one person, spoke to the forewoman. I said, please, you know, keep order here. And she said, I stopped listening days ago.
What caused you to hang on for these 3 days?
I felt he was innocent, and all those personal attacks on me had nothing to do with changing my mind. I asked them to give me a reason to change my mind. They never gave me a reason. I told them the reasons why I thought he was innocent. There were no fingerprints. The transaction that we supposedly saw, took place, and then 2 hours later he was arrested. When he was arrested, there were no drugs found on him and no marked bills. Three 20s and a 5 were found on him. That's not the change to be having in your pocket if you're selling $10 bags of heroin.
Leonard Levinson, tell us about your client's case, Calvin Baker, who remains in jail now for more than a year and a half.
Well, I think there was a substantial question as to whether or not the people proved the case beyond a reasonable doubt. I think Paula has indicated exactly some of the issues. The fact also that the police officer who testified and observed this 16 months before the time he testified without any notes. He was asked whether or not the things that he testified about were testified because it refreshed his recollection from notes that he had taken. He said no. When I asked him, do you remember any other cases, any of the details of any other cases, and he said no.
No videotape.
He indicated that he had made 100 arrests or more than 100 arrests since that time. He couldn't remember a single case that he arrested anyone on. This one he remembers in great, great detail. Plus, there was a person across the street selling drugs of the same nature that he's alleged to have, that the defendant is alleged to have sold.
So you hear this testimony, Paula Thompson. What convinced the other, was it 11 jurors?
Yes, eventually 11. Started with 9, and after 2 hours, the other two went over to the other side.
And what convinced them?
I heard arguments such as, well, he was found guilty in grand jury, so he's probably guilty. I heard arguments that he acts like a duck and looks like a duck, so he must be a duck. Those were the arguments I heard. They focused on the transaction. There was a supposed transaction that took place about 20 minutes after the detective was on duty looking through his binoculars. And supposedly a van stopped, and this man made this transaction that Mr. Levinson described, then went on in the van, and then later on this one bag of heroin was found on the floor with a cocaine pipe, and they didn't even... And they didn't even look any further in the van. I never heard of a drug bust where they would find one packet of heroin and not look further in the van. We never heard this man, McKinnon, testify. We didn't know who he was, if he was helping the police out or whatever. And there was something very strange that happened during the trial. Apparently, I told you this transaction took place 20 minutes after the detective showed up at his lookout spot. But Baker was left to stay on the street for 2 more hours. And what happened prior to his arrest was, according to all testimony, Mr. Baker walked over to the unmarked detective's car and looked in as if to say, I see who you are, and showed his gold teeth. We didn't know the meaning of that while we were jurors. And then they arrested him, and they said they arrested him because the detectives had been found out. But it seemed very strange. And then the judge stopped and said, I don't want those teeth being shown anymore. Don't do that anymore, Mr. Levinson. So we were kind of left hanging as to why that was. But also, we were not allowed to hear the arresting statement. So I suspected the arrested statement said something about how he flared his teeth and nothing about a bag of heroin. And we heard that there were 20 meetings between the DA and the undercover detectives to put this case and the other one, which probably didn't take any time at all together. So why they needed 20 meetings to put this together was suspicious.
So explain what happened afterwards, after the hung jury.
Okay. After the hung jury, they declared a mistrial. And what happens is that both the defense attorney and the DA come in and do a little, you know, hello, thank you for how serving, and they were allowed to ask questions, whereas before we're not allowed to ask questions. I went over to the DA and said, I'm really concerned why you didn't do fingerprints. And he said, they're too expensive. I said, how expensive are they? He said he didn't know. And then I asked Mr. Levinson why they didn't do fingerprints, and he said they only do them in cases of murder. So that means it's an open city in terms of planting evidence.
And so?
And so I felt the evidence was planted. There were about 6 bags of heroin that were retrieved from this man across the street who tried to swallow one bag when he was arrested. And there were about 6 bags, supposedly one on the van floor, and about 5 or 6 in the supposed stash. The stash was inside the apartment where Baker lives with his family, with his brothers. And it's one of those places where the mailmen keep their keys, but this was already busted open. So it was like a little cubbyhole. And that's where the supposed stash was, where 10 different families could walk by all the time, in and out of the building. It didn't make sense.
So you offered to pay his bail.
It didn't happen right like that. Mr. Levinson and the DA hand out their telephone numbers, and I contact Mr. Levinson a few days later, and I just wasn't thinking of paying bail right away. I told Mr. Levinson that when Baker was free and was looking for a job, I could probably help him find a job even if he had some prior conviction. I saw Baker following his trial, following it very carefully, taking notes and listening very diligently during the trial, so I thought he was a serious, capable person who was literate and so forth. And then I also said to Mr. Levinson, ironically enough, I don't want any publicity because during the jury deliberations, I felt what it was to be a lightning rod for hostility. All their hostility went out on me. So I said, if I put this in the public, the same thing will happen again. I'll just become a lightning rod for hostility, and it will not help Mr. Baker. But I since changed my mind about the value of publicity.
Mm-hmm. So you paid his bail?
No. Okay, that didn't happen right away. Then Mr. Levinson called me and said, Ms. Thompson, they're getting ready to increase the bail. I took that to mean that I should go and pay the bail. It was Mr. Levinson who instigated me, in a way, to go pay the bail. So I went and paid the bail, and then it backfired. And I think there's a mistake in the law journal. Calvin Baker was out for a week. And I came home. I want to tell you this. I came home this Monday after Easter, and there was a message on my machine about midnight. There was a message on my machine. Mr. Levinson said that Calvin Baker's bail had been raised, and I knew that Calvin Baker was out. I hadn't heard from him yet. So I was very consumed, and it was late at night, and I listened to BAI about 2 o'clock Tuesday morning, and there was Brother Shine and a woman talking, and they were talking about the justice system and so forth. So I called, and I said, what do you know about bail? How are they able to change bail after a person's out? That's why I rushed to pay the bail. And they didn't know, but the woman on the show said that I was getting too involved.
Well, let me ask you, Mr. Levinson, how did they change the bail? He gets out. Here the juror posted the bail, and a second judge increased the bail from $2,500 to $10,000?
Well, I think the theory was that the purpose of bail is to ensure that a defendant is going to show up. A person is more likely to show up if the person who posts the bail has a relationship with him. In other words, if a mother posts $2,500 bail, the defendant isn't going to be particularly interested in skipping because his mother would lose the money. The theory was that since the defendant didn't know Paula Thompson...
And they investigated your relationship, yeah. Right, with Mr. Baker. Because they wanted to perhaps challenge the verdict, saying that you had some kind of relationship with the defendant.
There'd be less motive for the defendant to come back. He didn't know Paula Thompson, theoretically at least. He couldn't care less whether she lost $2,500. Unfortunately, for that theory, the defendant did show up, did know that the bail could possibly be raised, because I told his brother that there's a possibility bail could be raised, and yet he still showed up.
We have Randy Credico on the line with us. He is with the William Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice, who's been looking at these cases, at drug cases in New York and around the country. Put this case in perspective for us, Randy Credico.
Well, it's a typical case here in New York and probably across the country. You have a kid, supposedly with a dime bag. You have so many cops in that area, in Harlem and 6 or 7 other areas in New York City, basically shanghaiing kids into the prison system with very flimsy evidence most of the time. Here's a guy who's facing 4.5 to 9, up to 12.5 to 25 years for a $10 bag of heroin. This is more time than Robert Chambers got for killing Jennifer Levin. This is more time than Dr. Steinberg got for killing a little kid. I mean, it's really outrageous. We're going to spend $300,000 to put young Calvin Baker in a New York maximum security prison. $300,000 instead of giving him money for education, giving him a job.
And the amount of time he has spent in jail so far?
He's been there for 16 months. I mean, you would think he had committed a murder or something. He's been there for 16, 17 months already on $2,500 bail. This is such a Mickey Mouse case. It costs $50,000 a year to put someone in Rikers, and then $35,000 a year to put him in a maximum security prison. So what's going to happen here? You take this guy with a $10 bag of heroin, which he didn't have. I really believe this story. You put him in a prison. He comes out after 5 or 10 years. Then what? Now, what kind of mindset is he going to have after that period of time? What interest is it to the state to put a kid away for that long a time? But the problem here is this kind of stuff happens all the time. Thank God you have people like, you have a person like Paula Thompson there who was willing. This is like 12 Angry Men, the same type of thing, only one person actually stood her ground here.
You
and
have...
I thought she was really gutsy to do that. I wish more jurors would say, okay, there's not enough evidence here. I'm not going to convict. I mean, the amount of time that they face is just impossible.
Leonard Levinson, this was a completely non-black jury. Is that right?
Yes. Well, let me say that there were three black jurors on the panel. The district attorney challenged all three. The judge ruled that the challenges for these three were based upon non-racial factors. Unfortunately, however, it was an all-white jury.
Randy Credico, how many people are in jail for low-level nonviolent drug offenses?
In the state of New York, about 23,000, and 10,000 people each year go to state prisons. Half of those for drug offenses to replenish the people getting out. So like 23,000. I've chronicled 1,000 cases. I have not found one major drug dealer in this state, not one out of 1,000 cases. These are all low-level cases. And it is really an epidemic. It is sick and something that has got to be addressed. And it's not just here, it's across the country. This whole war on drugs is a complete scam.
$10,000 bail right now. Compare that to murder cases.
Well, there was a guy, there was an armed robbery here a year ago, 2 years ago, a guy who committed three armed robberies. He was in Rikers on $3,500 bail. $3,500 bail, he was able to raise it. For three armed robberies, and he came out and he killed six people at Wendy's. Here's a guy in on a $10 bag. Do you know how many $10 bags are floating around Wall Street? Do you know how many $10 bags on the Upper East Side, the Upper West Side? This is not about stopping drugs. This is about crowd control. This is about prison industrial complex. This is a real cynical system that we have here. And you would think the state of New York and the city of New York and the borough of Manhattan would be the exception. What goes on across the country. It isn't. What goes on in Manhattan,
we have 30 seconds,
is the same thing that went on in Tulia, Texas, and everywhere else. You cannot get a fair trial in the city if you're black.
Paula Thompson, I'll give you the last word at this point.
During my deliberations with the jury, I was appalled at the level of unconscious white racism. Near the end, I tried to appeal to them and say, listen, it's a white man's law, and this is a black man as a defendant. They jumped on me, and they said, you're a racist. You're calling it a white man's law. I said, it's been white male presidents up till now. It's not, and they just felt the need to call me a white racist. And there were four women that were talking among themselves, and they said, you know, serving on jury duty lasting longer than they thought is worse than serving time in prison. I said, how so? They said, because we only get one free meal a day. They get three free meals and a free education. That was the attitude of the other jurors.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Paula Thompson, the dissenting juror in the trial of Calvin Baker, who will now be retrialed. His case ended with a hung jury. Leonard Levinson, an official with the New York Criminal Bar Association, the attorney for Calvin Baker, and Randy Credico of William Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. If people want to get in touch with the fund, where can they call?
They can call 212-539-8441 or kunstler.org. And that kid will be getting out today or tomorrow. We have found an anonymous donor to get that kid out of Rikers Island.
212-539-8441. You're listening to Moksha. Now, when we come back, we're going to take a look at the Peruvian plane that shot the missionary plane out of the air in Peru with the CIA's help. We are going to be talking about U.S. drug policy and what the CIA was doing in Peru. You're listening to Moksha. Now, back in a minute.
Thank you.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The funeral for Ronnie Bowers and her seven-month-old daughter will be held later this week. Bowers is the American missionary who was in a plane that was shot down by the Peruvian Air Force using targeting information provided by the CIA. The Washington Post is reporting in a front-page piece today that an audio tape made aboard a U.S. surveillance plane shows that its CIA crew expressed doubts about whether a civilian aircraft they were tracking was smuggling drugs 20 minutes before it was shot down last week by the Peruvian Air Force. But crew members did not vigorously object until just before the plane came under fire. U.S. officials previously said the three crew members strenuously resisted the shootdown, but the tape described to the Washington Post by U.S. officials shows the crew members displayed little urgency as the Peruvian jet approached. The Air Interdiction Program is a cooperative venture between the United States and the Peruvian Air Force. Since 1994, Peruvian warplanes have shot down more than 30 small aircraft. The program is fundamentally dependent on the United States, which provides radar and listening technology located in land bases in Peru and aboard spy planes operated by CIA contract employees who are mostly retired U.S. military airmen with combat experience. U.S. officials in Washington said similar programs operate with the air forces of other drug-affected countries. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said the operations in other countries are continuing despite the suspension in Peru. In the Washington Post piece, it says that under the intelligence sharing agreement between Peru and the United States, the decision to open fire on an aircraft can be made solely by Peruvian military officials, while the U.S. crew remains out of the chain of command. This understanding, designed to relieve personnel of responsibility for intercepting civilian aircraft, also precludes them from interceding to call off questionable missions. But two former pilots for the CIA operation said the surveillance crew might have been able to avert the downing of the missionary plane simply by changing course and withholding radar information from the Peruvian jet. That jet is not equipped with radar essential for locating a target. We're joined right now by Ethan Nadelman, who is head of the Linda Smith Drug Policy Foundation and author of Cops Across Borders, the Internationalization of U.S. Criminal Law Enforcement. Coletta Youngers joins us on the phone. She's a senior associate with the Washington Office on Latin America. Ethan Nadelman, what is the CIA doing in Peru?
Well, you know, Amy, I think it's probably not right to separate out the CIA from the whole rest of the U.S. drug policy in Peru. I mean, the CIA is just one of many agencies. There's the State Department, there's the DEA, there's the Customs, there's military intelligence, there's the National Security Agency, and they're all working on behalf of a U.S. policy that has been a demonstrable and overwhelming failure for 60 years. You know, these efforts that we pursue to try to keep coca from being grown in Latin America and cocaine from being exported, we've been doing this for 50 or 60 years. There's some wonderful books by a fellow named William O. Walker that traces it back to the 1930s and 40s. You know, let's try to get the peasants to stop growing it, to stop exporting it, what have you. It's a failure. It continues to fail and fail and fail. Now, what happened with the missionary woman and her child and her family being shot down, that's just a collateral casualty in the war on drugs. One of the fundamental distinctions between a criminal justice law enforcement policy and a war policy is you don't accept collateral casualties in the former. It's not acceptable for a policeman to shoot after a fleeing felon if innocents may be killed. But in wartime, we accept that the killing of innocent civilians may be part of the price one has to pay. You know, now we have John Ashcroft, the new attorney general in the Bush administration, who represents the worst of what the Republican administration has to offer. He said, let's restore the war on drugs. I don't like the fact that McCaffrey didn't want to talk about a war on drugs anymore. We need a war on drugs. And I think here's one of the first indications that they're getting serious about that. It's not clear to me that the CIA was specifically at fault in this specific incident. It goes back to a general policy that the U.S. has pursued look, is she the only victim? Are they the only victims of U.S. policy down there? Do you know how many thousands, tens of thousands of people have been tortured in foreign prisons and jails because of evidence provided by U.S. law enforcement officials to foreign police agencies with the knowledge that torture was part of their standard interrogating procedure? What happens every day in America when police bash down doors with, you know, paramilitary uniforms on and kids are screaming, you know, sometimes things are going off. They want to arrest because one member of the family, a brother, a sister, sister, a parent is a suspect in a drug case, the whole family is terrorized. Innocent people die. Parents drop dead of heart attacks. Kids are traumatized for years to come. Those are all negative consequences of the drug war.
Before we go into that larger issue, Coletta Younger is on the issue of the CIA in Peru. What about its history, whether it's flying a plane and giving intelligence information to the Peruvian military or supporting Vladimiro Montesinos, the right-hand man of Fujimori, who recently left in disgrace and may be wanted for crimes against humanity if they can get him back from Japan?
A lot we don't know about what the CIA has been doing in Peru, particularly over the last decade, but what we do know is precisely what you indicated, that they have had a close working relationship with Vladimiro Montesinos. We now know that that relationship went back to the 1970s. He, of course, was Fujimori's sinister right-hand man, who, because of the evidence that's come out recently, we now have proof that he was engaged in massive corruption, gun running, and drug trafficking. Ironically, he was considered to be Fujimori's drug czar, and he is the person credited with having putting this air interdiction program in place with the U.S. government. Moreover, the CIA has worked with the Peruvian intelligence services, the SEAN, which Montesinos oversaw, which has been engaged in systematic death squad activity and virtually served as Peru's political police under the Fujimori government. And we know that in the early 1990s, the CIA provided assistance to an anti-drug unit of the SEAN that is believed to have been engaged in death squad activity. The U.S. also continued to provide anti-drug aid to the SEAN over the course of the 1990s, even as their repression of Fujimori's political opponents increased. So in addition to these surveillance operations that have been highlighted in the press recently, under the guise of the drug war, the U.S. has forged close ties with one of the most abusive intelligence services in the region.
And now, with this latest downing, we're not actually only talking about Ronnie Bowers. Her husband did survive in this plane, this missionary plane, a Baptist missionary plane, but the pilot, his legs were shot up, and, well, they'll see if he's able to walk again. He ultimately was able to land the plane in the water, and people from villagers paddled out and saved those that remained on the plane. But the use of the CIA in the overall war on drugs, as you point out, Ethan Edelman, it goes beyond the CIA. And you have been documenting for years international law enforcement, or the internationalization of U.S. law enforcement more specifically.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you have to sort it out in a way. The DEA, the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration, its principal objective is to take out drug traffickers and drug trafficking organizations. That's what it does. The CIA's job has, by and large, been to collect intelligence, and it used to be to fight the communists. Now they're beginning to fight some of the drug dealers. One reason you oftentimes have conflicts between the DEA and the CIA is that sometimes, as Coletta was pointing out, some of the people who are most effective at taking out drug trafficking organizations are themselves working in league with other drug trafficking organizations. That was true of the Mexican drug czar, who McCaffrey applauded just shortly before it was revealed that he was in bed with drug traffickers. This was the fellow who was shown in the movie Traffic. They based that story upon him. But, you know, Amy, once again, to step back to a broader level on this thing, you know, one has to look at the overall U.S. strategy in the region on the drug issue. A few months ago, I was speaking to an audience at the Hoover Institution of police chiefs and other law enforcement officials, and I asked them the question, how many of you think if we got serious, we could really keep these drugs out of the country, the cocaine and heroin? I think one hand out of 50 went up. Because what they know is that if you add up the 10 or 20 tons of heroin consumed in this country each year, the 100 or 200 tons of cocaine consumed in this country each year, that represents an infinitesimal portion of all the goods and people and tons of steerage coming into this country each year. Trying to find those 200 or 300 tons of illegal drugs amidst the billions and billions of tons of goods coming into this country each year makes looking for a needle in a haystack seem like child's play in comparison. It's impossible. If, in fact, there were a market for 5 or 10 times that much cocaine or heroin in America, it would come through. Now, there's a second issue. So imagine, we can't stop the stuff from coming in. It's hard for Americans to accept that our borders are porous, but somehow that's the reality of the matter. Imagine that somehow you could wave a wand or snap your fingers and all the cocaine and heroin in the world would simply disappear. Now, how how much difference would that make to America's problem with drugs, our drug abuse problem? And if you think about it, marijuana, we're the number one producer of marijuana now, and methamphetamine, and LSD, and there are pharmaceutical substances, OxyContin, other things like that. There's methamphetamine, you name it. The bottom line is that drug abuse is not ultimately about the supply of these drugs. It's about people's finding chemical substance to deal with their pain, their boredom, their whatever it might be. We're not going to solve America's drug problem by somehow allocating all of these resources abroad, by sending the CIA and the DEA and all this other sort of stuff abroad. That's not the answer. There is not an effective answer on this, what's called the supply side. It ultimately has to come to addressing the problem in America. And the answer ultimately is not about supply reduction or demand reduction. The answer is ultimately about something called harm reduction, which is accepting that drugs are here to stay, accepting that we're never going to get rid of drugs, accepting that most people who use drugs don't have a problem with them, but some people do, and that what we ultimately want to do is to make drugs as least as little harmful as possible, both to individuals and society at large.
Ethan Nadelman, what about John Walters?
Well, John Walters is the fellow who it is said to be the new drug czar, that President Bush is about to appoint to be the new drug czar. John Walters is probably worse than John Ashcroft when it comes to drug policy, which is really saying something. John Walters was William Bennett's deputy, first in the Education Department, then the drug czar's office. He then left with William Bennett to go work on for a project, I think the Citizen Project it was called, promoting a very, very reactionary and repressive political agenda in America. You know, I know John Walters for the last 10 years. We've had many conversations. He is a true believing drug war ideologue. I was reading some of his testimony to Congress. He was the fellow that the Republicans would send up to blast the Clinton drug policy over the last 8 years for being too soft on drugs, even while the number of people in prison was doubling and resources were doubling and all this sort of stuff. John Walters is somebody who has minimal faith in drug treatment. He basically believes that anybody who uses a drug deserves to be punished by the government, to lose their freedom. I encourage people, by the way, there's a front page story in the Wall Street Journal today about the Higher Education Act and the fact that Congress passed a law a few years ago that says if you've ever been busted on a drug charge, even marijuana possession, you are deprived of access for any federal funding to go to college. Now, mind you, if you've been busted for murder or rape, you're still eligible. Marijuana possession, you're out. Now, if you think about that, and mind you, the fellow who promoted the law, Mark Souter, Republican congressman, he's saying, I did not realize what I supported. I wanted this ban only to apply to people who were convicted while they were receiving aid, not to this to be some sort of lifetime ban. I mean, Souter and many other Republicans, including Gary Johnson in New Mexico, basically believe that once people have served their time, we should not have lifetime penalties. We're not reenacting the Bible where, you know, if somebody commits a sin, their children, their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, all their cattle and their horses all get subject to punishment
now,
for all time.
Now, repeat, if they are convicted, so this is if they plea bargain?
Yeah, anybody who pleas, if that is on your record.
So if you take a case like New York, and New York is certainly not the only state that has Rockefeller drug laws where young people can face something like 20, 25 years
yeah.
if they're caught with drugs.
Yeah, but Amy,
or
I'm not even talking about Rockefeller drug laws. I'm talking about there's 1.5 million arrests in this country each year. Half of them, just about 700,000, are for marijuana. 85% of those, roughly 600,000 people, get arrested and plead guilty to a petty marijuana offense each year. New York City averaged 4,000 marijuana arrests a year in the early to mid-1990s. In 1999, it hit 40,000, and last year it went over 60,000 marijuana arrests. New York City, with about 2.5% of the country's population, has almost 10% of the marijuana arrests. So we're talking about 16, 17, 18, 19-year-old, 20-year-old kids, good kids, kids with no other criminal records. You know, we're talking about among the 40% of American youth who have tried marijuana, we're talking about that percentage who got unlucky and got popped and had to plead guilty to a little marijuana misdemeanor charge. They are now banned for life from federal aid for going to college. Unless, of course, they go to a drug treatment program to fix their marijuana problem, which they never had in the first place.
But then you also have the young people who are terrified of the onerous sentences they face if they are innocent, but they go to trial and are found guilty, and so they plea bargain out, and then they don't get any kind
of
aid.
No, that's also true. I mean, one of the things is that when you build up a drug war machinery like we have now, remember, the federal government is spending about $20 billion a year now in the drug war. That's up from $1 billion 20 years ago, and two-thirds of that is for enforcement. State and local governments are spending more than that again. We have a $40, $50 billion drug war going on now. We have hundreds of thousands of people employed in this. We're basically warehousing people. I mean, Randy Credico said it before. 50,000 people behind bars on drug charges in 1980, almost 500,000 of our fellow citizens behind bars on on drug charges today. America locks up more people for violating the drug laws than all of Europe locks up for everything. And they have 100 million more people than we do. There's when you have a warehousing system like this, what you're essentially doing is throwing in the innocents with the guilties, throwing in the petty violators with the major violators. You know, under alcohol prohibition, we made a distinction between grandma and her bathtub gin and Al Capone. According to our laws, or federal conspiracy laws, or Rockefeller drug laws, there is no distinction anymore. In fact, quite the contrary, the big cats at the top have the information to trade, to plea bargain down, whereas the people at the bottom have nothing to trade, so they end up serving the onerous sentences.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. We're talking to Ethan Nadelman, head of the Linda Smith Drug Policy Foundation and author of Cops Across Borders. We're going to continue the conversation, but for people who have to leave or happen to have pens in their hands right now, what is the number of the Linda Smith Center?
Well, first, our website's drugpolicy.org. So that's where you can find out a lot of information. Our phone number in New York is 548-0695.
That's 212?
212-548-0695. And before you go to the break, just to say there's going to be a gathering in New Mexico at the end of May, the largest gathering, most significant gathering ever of people trying to end the war on drugs. If you want to be there, find out more information, call 548-0695 or else go to our website, drugpolicy.org.
And we'll continue with Ethan Nadelman, head of the Linda Smith Drug Policy Foundation, in just a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our conversation on the war on drugs, that we began by talking about the missionary plane that was shot out of the air in Peru, the Peruvian military using CIA intelligence information to target the plane. And at the top of the show, our top news story was an elite U.S.-trained Colombian Army battalion has killed rebel fighters for the first time. The Army said that the money that they're using from Plan Colombia, which funded Operation Hurricane, was aimed at drugs and not at combating rebel forces. But this was an elite U.S.-trained Colombian Army battalion. Fit what's going on in Colombia into overall U.S. drug policy and how successful it is.
Yeah, I sometimes think of Colombia as comparable to Chicago under Al Capone times 10. Right? What happened in Chicago in the 1920s, where Al Capone basically took over the city, was a result of alcohol prohibition. It wasn't just a result of alcohol. It was a result of alcohol prohibition and things getting out of control. Well, Colombia's situation is very much similar to that, but much more serious. Right? Colombia has been both the beneficiary in some economic respects, but much more the victim of a global drug prohibition regime that the U.S. has, you know, driven for the last century, basically. Colombia, for a variety of reasons, has been central to the drug trade for 20, 30, 40 years, everything from its terrain to its entrepreneurial traditions to its proximity to the United States. It's been a major source of cocaine and marijuana for many years, and in the last 10 years, it's become a major source of heroin. Now, what's happened there, unfortunately, is that the drug traffickers became so powerful that at various points they actually threatened the whole civil order, threatened to take over the country. Now, the U.S. has responded in a way that I'm convinced has only made things worse. I mean, Colombia is in a country where there are many people trying to deal with this, but they've essentially had presidential candidates assassinated. They've had Supreme Court judges assassinated. They've had the equivalents of the editors of the New York Times and the FBI assassinated. Thousands, if not tens of thousands of people killed by the drug lords and by paramilitary forces and by guerrillas and what have you. I mean, it's a horrible, horrible situation. I believe there's more internal refugees in Colombia than the rest of the world put together. Coletta may have better information than I on that. But quite frankly, Colombia is the victim of the drug prohibitionist policies of the United States. In many of the dialogues that I've been part of over the last 12 years, you start off, you all sit around the table, it's very polite. People talk about reducing the supply, reducing the demand, respecting sovereignty, blah, 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 and nothing ever changes. Then people break, they go and have dinner, they have a coffee, they have a beer, and they start talking about the reality. And what happens is half the Colombians sitting there saying, you know, this whole drug war is a disaster. The real answer here is to legalize the damn stuff. Colombia doesn't have a drug problem. We have a drug prohibition problem. The same is true of Mexico and Peru and Bolivia and the Caribbean and Central America and what have you. We have a drug prohibition problem. We have an America problem, and we don't know what to do with. And the problem is you have this polite public dialogue that goes nowhere. You have this frustrated private dialogue that says, what the hell, legalize the stuff, which is what President Vicente Fox of Mexico just popped out with a few weeks ago. It's what the president of Uruguay, Bacha, just popped out with a couple of months ago. But there's no place for it to go. I think what we really need to do is to move towards reshaping the entire dialogue. It's where, once again, the notion of harm reduction becomes valuable. It's accepting that we're never going to get rid of drugs. There's billions of poor peasants who are always going to try to find a way to make a few bucks by growing these things. There are people all around the world who seek to consume these things for all sorts of reasons. Let's accept that reality. Let's begin to figure out ways to control this stuff. Let's figure out ways, if we can't go to legalization today, there are both risks associated with it and it's politically impossible. But there's some middle ground where we can begin to carve portions of this market out of the black market, where we can focus on reducing not just the harms of drugs, but the violence and the crime and the corruption, the environmental degradation and the human rights abuses that attend the war on drugs. When we can have that 90-degree shift in our thinking, then I think we begin to identify some long-term solutions. Because if we don't go that way, 10, 20, 30 years from now, every radio and TV station is going to have our children on discussing the same problem with a magnitude times 10.
Well, what about the what drives the debate over the war on drugs in a certain direction? You've got the the Corrections Corporation of America, CCA, one of the largest growing for-profit prison industries, along with Wackenhut. You've got the U.S. military that is benefiting tremendously because of U.S. weaponry being sold to, and U.S., just like this plane that was used to target the missionary plane. So they profit from this tremendously.
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's very interesting. When you look at the interests that are driving this thing, it's true that, I mean, the correction corporations and even more so the corrections officers' unions are an economic force. Although I'll tell you, they've been discreet so far. When we had this ballot initiative in California, Prop 36, to provide treatment instead of incarceration and reduce the flow of nonviolent drug possession offenders into prison, both the private prison folk and ultimately the correction officers' union laid rather low on that sort of stuff. And as for the U.S. military, 15, even 10 years ago, they were dead set opposed to being involved in the war on drugs. They kept getting pushed by the government, the feds, and Congress to get into it. Now they're into it. Now they've developed rationalizations for why it's good for the military. I'm much more concerned about what might be called the drug prohibition enforcement complex. Remember Eisenhower's farewell speech to the military-industrial complex? Well, there are now hundreds of thousands of people employed in the criminal justice system for whom it's not just the economic interest, it's almost an existential interest. I interviewed, that book, Cops Across Borders, was based upon interviews with DEA guys all around the world. You know, part of it was their job. Part of it was they spent 20 years fighting for what they believe is to protect Americans from drugs. And one part of them knows it's entirely futile, but do they want to accept that their whole life was a waste, that it was all down the drain, that they were just like the prohibition agents during alcohol prohibition? They don't. And the really underlying stuff, the stuff that's hardest to get at, it's not about economics. It's about people's fears. It's about people's fears for their kids and some irrational hope that somehow the drug war can make the world safer for our kids, even though the evidence is all to the contrary. And it's also about a temperance ideology. Remember, America is one of the few countries to prohibit alcohol. We actually believe we could solve our nation's problems by banning alcohol. We learned we couldn't, but we haven't learned that lesson with the other stuff. America's almost unique in the Western world in having a temperance, abstinence-only, sobriety-only, have people forced into drug-freeness ideology that goes deep into our historical soul. And that's the stuff out of which a lot of this ugly stuff festers.
you talk about the internationalization of U.S. law. We've been watching with the anti-globalization protests, the FBI setting up an office in Prague and providing information to the Czech authorities about U.S. activists. We certainly saw that in Canada with people being stopped along the border from going into Canada, Canadian officials getting information from the U.S. What about that happening around the world and fitting that into the...
You know, one of the things, I mean, there's a proselytizing dimension to what we do in the area of drug policy. In a way, if we look inward, we see what a farce our drug policy is. And there's a way, I think, of justifying what we do and of legitimizing it by imposing it upon everybody else around the world. I mean, this really does go back 100 years. 100 years, we've been promoting a U.S. orientation on dealing with drugs all around the world. Now, in the last 30 years, beginning under President Nixon, we've actually built up probably the most substantial global law enforcement agency ever in history. I mean, the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration has offices, I think, in 60 or 70 cities around the world, 50 or 60 countries. Now, the FBI is doing the same thing. Customs is doing the same thing. The CIA has been out there since it was created after World War II. We really do have a global security presence that's really about enforcing the internationalization of U.S. criminal laws and norms. Now, some of this is perfectly acceptable and understandable, but when it goes, as I said before, to the point of providing information and arranging for the arrest of people by foreign law enforcement agencies where we know those people are going to be tortured as part of their standard operating procedure, that should not be permissible. When it goes to the point of having civilian casualties like this missionary lady and her child, that should not be acceptable. I mean, there are points where we have just gone to, we are actually exerting substantial influence on getting foreign countries to change their enforcement processes. You know, the whole U.S. reliance on undercover operations and on informants, we rely on that much more so than many other countries. In fact, throughout much of Europe until recently, it was prohibited to use undercover operatives and to rely on informants and make deals with them. Now we have transformed their criminal justice systems.
I think it's very interesting in your book, Cops Across Borders, The Internationalization of U.S. Criminal Law Enforcement, you trace the U.S. law going international back to going after fugitive slaves.
Yeah. In fact, it's even interesting. If you go back 100 years ago, you see that we had a very active law enforcement relationships along the U.S.-Mexican border. And during the Mexican Civil War 100 years ago, there were actually more armed Mexican law enforcement agents on our side of the border than there were U.S. agents on the other side. It's a very funny history where basically, I mean, look, we live in an increasingly interdependent world. There are serious threats from global organized crime, global terrorist problems. There's no question about that. And we all have some interest in being protected against that. Unfortunately, the drug thing is a bottomless pit. It's basically a justification for unlimited enhancements in law enforcement funding, law enforcement procedures. It's been the foot in the door. When the Supreme Court justices talk about a drug war exception to the Bill of Rights, it's because of our hysteria about the drug war. Now, I'll tell you something. I mean, people keep telling me this is just going to keep on going because there are not enough Americans who see an interest in ending the war on drugs. The plea I want to make on your show is that if people really think the war on drugs is a bad thing, I mean, if they hope that one day our children will look back on the war on drugs at the turn of this century the same way we look back now on Jim Crow and slavery in this country, then people have to get enraged. They have to get excited. They got to join. They got to make this their number one issue. I mean, 500,000 of our fellow citizens behind bars for nonviolent offenses, that should get people upset. 750,000 people arrested every year on marijuana, that should get people upset. So I'm asking people, join us. I mean, come to New Mexico. Come to Albuquerque at the end of May. Join the Linda Smith Center Drug Policy Foundation. Start up or join your local drug reform organization. If a movement begins to build, this can end. Innocents will stop getting shot out of the skies in Latin America. Innocent people will stop going to prison. And people who commit petty offenses will not be losing their lives as a result.
The front page of the Washington Post today, police win latitude on minor cases. Police may arrest people without a warrant and take them into custody for minor offenses punishable only by a fine. This, the Supreme Court ruled yesterday in a decision that could reshape everyday interactions between law enforcement and ordinary citizens. By a 5-4 vote, the court held that a Texas police officer was not required by the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, which bans unreasonable searches and seizures, to get a warrant before he handcuffed handcuffed a woman and took her to jail for letting her children ride in her pickup truck without seatbelts. And you have Justice Sandra Day O'Connor saying, indeed, as the recent debate over racial profiling demonstrates all too clearly, a minor traffic infraction may often serve as an excuse for stopping and harassing an individual. But you can put this into the drug context as well, people being stopped on a regular basis, and they can just be put into jail.
You know, Amy, I was disappointed at the Supreme Court Justice Souter for writing that decision, because he's usually reflected other values in his decisions. You know, it really comes down to the question of how we define a civilized society. Now, you know, in New York City right now, marijuana is decriminalized in New York State. The state decriminalized it 25 years ago, at least in private. In New York City, 60,000 people were arrested on marijuana charges, almost entirely for possession last year. Now, what happens to them? They get arrested, they get handcuffed, they get thrown in the back of a police van for anywhere up to 4 or 5 hours. They get sent down to the jail, they get booked, they're fingerprinted, they may be strip searched. They're then thrown in a jail cell with people who may be much more serious and violent criminals than this marijuana smoking person, right? Then ultimately, spend up to 48 hours there, and then they appear before a judge who more or less dismisses it or slaps their hand, and it's the end of it. But that 48-hour experience, now contrast that. Which is the more or less civilized experience? Somebody walking down the street smoking a joint, or hanging out in Central Park or Prospect Park smoking a joint, not bothering a single soul, just being there? Or the state coming in, frisking you, engaging in violence, throwing you in a van, taking away your freedom for 2 days? What's the definition of a civilized society? And the horrifying thing about the Supreme Court decision yesterday is they're basically saying that the power of the state should extend literally to locking up a mother in front of her children because she forgot to put the seatbelts on. Now, there's some point at which we say that role of the state has to have certain limits. We can't have people being subject to the physical force on the state when they present no harm whatsoever to the broader society.
Do you think that the drug issue breaks down conservative liberal barriers? You talk about speaking to law enforcement, for example. You talk about the state invading people's lives, which is an issue that the right deals with also.
You know, it's the one reason I have some hope here. I mean, it was a bizarre experience last year, but the two leading politicians in America last year calling for an end to the war on drugs, who were most courageous and most bold, was a libertarian Republican governor of New Mexico, Gary Johnson, who actually became the most knowledgeable governor in the country and who ended up introducing and enacting legislation to make clean needles more available, to stop the spread of AIDS, to reduce heroin overdoses, to make medical marijuana available. He was the leader. And in California, we had a Republican congressman, Tom Campbell, running for the Senate against Dianne Feinstein. Dianne Feinstein, a full-blooded drug warrior. Tom Campbell speaking to our values, progressive values on this issue. Now, I'll tell you something. I even look in the Bush administration. Bush gave an interview with Larry King right before he became president where he sounded more moderate than Clinton did at any moment toward the end. John DiIulio in the White House.
Maybe
heading
he has
the office,
personal interest, though.
Could well be. But John DiIulio, heading the Office of Faith-Based Affairs, who previously co-authored a book with William Bennett, has now been writing op-ed pieces calling for the repeal of the Rockefeller drug laws. So, you know, there are reasons to believe. George Shultz, the former Secretary of Everything in Republican administrations, he's on our side on this issue. And Johnson was not alone in New Mexico. The chairman of the Republican Party, some of the other key Republicans, backed him on this stuff. So I actually think that there's a libertarian streak which runs more deeply and profoundly in the Republican Party than it does in the Democratic Party. And that's the one possible silver lining. I'm not going to hold my breath for a Nixon goes to China drug war strategy on the part of President Bush. But if there's any reason to believe it, it's because the libertarian streak runs profoundly in the Republican Party. And there's a lot of people in that party who are saying the drug war is entirely bust.
Ethan Nadelman, head of the Linda Smith Drug Policy Foundation and author of Cops Across Borders, The Internationalization of U.S. Criminal Law Enforcement. The conference is taking place in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
That's right, Albuquerque, May 30th to June 2nd. You can go to our website, drugpolicy.org, for more information, or you can call us in New York, 212-548-0695.
That's 212-548-0695. I know there's a major protest outside Governor Pataki's office on May 8th against the Rockefeller drug laws as well. That does it for the program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. It's 1-800-735-0230. Tomorrow on Democracy Now! We'll be joined by a Gwich'in woman from Alaska fighting Arctic drilling, Oronto Douglas from Nigeria fighting Chevron today. There is a Chevron shareholders conference in shareholders meeting in Los Angeles, and we'll be talking about oil around the world. I'm Amy Goodman. Chris Abrams and Anthony Sloan directed and engineered today's show from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners. Thanks for listening.
They started to realize that this new technology had probably been rushed to market.